How you doing, Robert?
Very good, nicely done. The key thing is always to get the applause for lasting long enough for the star to get to the chair.
Absolutely, that'd be embarrassing if it stopped.
Robert, how fantastic to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Thank you very much indeed for coming back. Edinburgh has some special memories, I would think, for you.
Yeah, I go way, way back in Edinburgh, way back to my theatre days as well, you know.
So, okay, so theatre days, so you're a Glasgow boy.
I am.
So was it the Glasgow Theatre or the Edinburgh Theatre that came first?
Well, I mean, I very first started coming through here doing devised and improvised stuff, in actual fact. My own theatre company, which is called Rain Dog Theatre, way, way back, we'd come through here.
That's after a Tom Waits song, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. It's from Rain Dogs, the album. We would sort of hire a venue and we would put on a wee play. It's really, and I think about it, that's why I'm hesitating. It's quite sad when I think back.
Are you afraid that
no one would come? You know what I mean? No one ever heard of it, you know.
I don't think that's true. See, I think you clearly, now I would think it's either then, because you did some Royal Academy stuff as well and then gave that up because I don't think it was a cultural match, really, was it?
The Royal Academy. Not particularly.
But the Trainspotting book you were familiar with before the movie and before you're in the movie, because you had worked, you were talking about improv and that kind of stuff. Hadn't you used parts of the book anyway in various sort of theatrical versions?
Yeah, we'd, Rain Dog Theatre Company, we had essentially stolen bits of the book and improvised some scenes around about that. We did a few little pieces leading up to a piece that we did called Ecstasy, which was an awful lot of the Trainspotting stuff was in that. And we toured that around for quite a while in Scotland. It came through to Edinburgh as well. So I knew the book pretty well before the film came round, yeah.
So which roles did you take in that version?
Renton, yeah. Somebody else took that part in the film.
And where are we now? There's been a lot of discussion recently about we're going to see, you know, the sequel to Trainspotting on screen. I don't know whether it's confirmed or not. Where are we with that? What's happening?
Well, I did a benefit for the London Film School about a month ago, and that was the first time that I'd heard Danny Boyle actually speak about it as a real thing. And as far as I know now, it's going to go ahead. It just depends on the script now. It has to be good. And it's not a done deal. I mean, I can't speak, obviously, for the rest of the actors.
Not sure.
But for me, you know, I would work with Danny Boyle any day of the week. But it's important that the script for this is good, because, you know, the previous film was so popular, such a massive, massive cultural thing, particularly up here in Scotland, that it would be ridiculous to do something that would undercut that in any way. But I have to say that if anybody can pull it off, Danny Boyle's the man.
Well, the interesting thing was when he was talking about it, because I interviewed him a few months ago, and he said he really felt that people wanted to know what had happened to these people, and he really felt that they wanted, and he was talking about them as characters that was, you know, still alive for him. And he did sound, I mean, it sounded like it really was something that was a proper go project.
Well, I think so. I mean, Danny has always been adamant that he always wanted to do the sequel, as it were, when we were the correct age. And I'm definitely, definitely the correct age
now. How old are you?
I'm 52 now, yes.
Why do you look 10 years younger than me?
I think that would be fantastic to see all the guys together 15 years on down the line and see how well
with any hesitation about, you know, going back and doing it again?
Yes. I mean, I would be a liar if I said I'm not. I mean, again, at the moment, it's still too far away to really be thinking about it properly. But when it has come into my mind, it's like, God, are you doing the right thing here? Because it was such, I mean, Begbie was such a massive, massive character.
Career-defining, would that be fair?
I would say that's fair, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the one. I can be in a street in Bulgaria and people will go, oh, Begbie.
Just out of interest, it's a fairly youthful crowd that we have here in Screen 7. Can you put your hands up if you've seen Trainspotting? Now that,
wow.
I think that's like 99%.
I would say so.
Is there anyone who hasn't seen Trainspotting?
Okay. Get out.
it's just a handful of shame-faced people. So who'd like to hear a bit of Begbie? Okay. So that, now I have to say, this is almost as heavily bleeped as last week's podcast. Right. So we've done what we had to do. So here's Begbie, here's Trainspotting.
Got to the scene. Meet you in the ball with Tommy playing pool. I'm playing like Paul Newman, by the way. Giving a boy here the turn into a lifetime. So it comes to the end, the last shot, a deciding boy of the whole tournament. I'm in a black, me sitting in the corner looking off Whisker Hurst. And that's hard comes in. Obviously fancied himself like. Starts staring at me. Looking at me right at me as if they say, come ahead, square go.
Are you kidding me? I'm not the type of that goes looking for bother like, but at the end of the day, I'm the with a pool cue and he could have a fat end in his puss anytime he wanted like. So I squares up. Casual like. How does a hard do? Or a so-called hard puts down his drink, turns and gets the out of it. And after that, one again was mine.
Well, so serious.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's interesting because I wonder, we've almost drawn attention to it by bleeping it all out. But after about 10 minutes, I think it, if you're just watching the actual movie, you sort of, you just become absorbed by the language.
Washes over you in the end, yeah. I think, you know. I mean, it's just the way he is. It's just the way that character is. I think that someone told me that I said the C word more than, in one particular scene, more than any other scene in history. It's very proud of that.
I was thinking about you this morning when I was coming up, thinking, I wonder if I'll still feel scared of you. But there is something about your performance in that movie. But also, again, for people of a certain age who saw you in Cracker, when you were playing Albie, which was one of the most terrifying performances I've ever seen on television. But there is something about you, Robert, which is but you're scary.
Stop.
That's a compliment, by the way.
I know, well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say that you're scared of me.
He's never said that to me. He's not scared of me.
Well, it's interesting with Begbie, if I can just speak a wee bit more about him, that, to be honest with you, I never really seen Begbie as being necessarily real, you know? That he was, Irvin Welsh had told me that Begbie was a composite of about four or five guys that he knew. And that was kind of it for me. I thought, well, there's no real one thing here then. He's kind of, he's big, he's massive. So the way that he is, and what I tried to do, initially when the costume fittings came along, the costume designer had brought combat trousers and leather jackets and stuff like that, and bother boots. I was like, I don't see it like that, you know. And I remembered back in that time, there was, if anybody knows, anybody that's my age will remember the dreadful Intercity firm. And this was guys who would dress up very smart, go on trains and go to football matches and smash up towns and stuff like that. And I thought, that's the kind of guy he is, and the brighter the colours, the better for him. I wanted Begbie's clothes to be, you know, enough to make people look, and one little look would have been enough to go, what you want, you know, I mean, that would have been, you did it again. not that he's cartoon, I'm not trying to say that, he's not cartoon or even so much caricature, but he's certainly heightened, he's a heightened figure, and I don't think he's someone that you would necessarily see in the streets of Glasgow and Edinburgh. I don't think he'd last 2 minutes.
Did it surprise you that the film became the sort of cultural touchstone that it did? Because there was a point when it was like a certain generation's Clockwork Orange. It's interesting, we asked here how many people had seen it. Everyone pretty much had seen it, with a few shamefaced exceptions. But it was one of those films. I mean, I was working at Radio 1 when it came out, and there was the soundtrack album, there was the posters, there was the spin-off soundtrack album. It was an absolute phenomenon. And yet, if you'd said at the beginning, this is the source material, this is going to be, it just wouldn't have seemed like an obvious fit.
No, because, I mean, for a start, there's no real story. If you think about it, you know, if you said to anybody in the audience, could you describe what Trainspotting's about? It's about four guys. That's about it, really. And so John Hodge did a wonderful job in the screenplay to actually make it into anything at all. And Irvin Welsh will tell you that himself. He always said, I don't know how they're ever going to make this into a film. And it's testament to Danny's genius. And also a guy who doesn't get an awful lot of mentions is the DOP.
Brian Tufano.
Tufano, who was absolutely wonderful. And he was the one who then showed the colour palette that he used in the film was then, you know, echoed and copied by clothes designers and stuff for years and years after. People were suddenly wearing lime green t-shirts and orange and stuff like that. And that all came from the film. So, of course not at the time, as you say. You would never have thought it was going to be that big or going to have that kind of influence. But when it was all put together, somehow it just worked.
Would Begbie still be alive at 52?
Begbie should be exactly where he should be. He should be in the nick or dead. That's basically it.
We'll do more with Robert Carlyle in just a moment. It's 3:10. We'll update you on the travel. Orna has that and more with Robert Carlyle in just a second.
Thank you, Simon. The M62 is closed eastbound from Ainley Top at junction 24 to 25 at Brickhouse. It's all because a coach has caught fire. It looks as though the fire has been put out, but the road is closed for safety reasons and the passengers are on the hard shoulder. Queues are backing up to junction 23 at Huddersfield. We've got delays on the M25. Anti-clockwise, the road's partly blocked near junction 1B at Dartford following an accident. And the M25 clockwise at junction 23 at the A1M. We had an accident. It has been cleared, but queues are back to junction 21A at St Albans. The M67 looking busy in Manchester. It's the eastbound side, it's just congestion, but looking quite heavy from Hyde at junction 3, heading towards junction 4 at Mottram. Looking at the A roads, and Sunderland Highway is still closed after a lorry overturned. That was between Washington Highway and Windlass Lane. We also had delays on Stokesley Road in North Yorkshire between Brompton and North Allerton, but that road has reopened. And in Telford in Shropshire, New Trench Road, the A518, is still closed after an accident very near to Garrison Roundabout. Warner Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
BBC Three's It's a Mad World season begins with exclusive access to the McGuinness Mental Health Unit in Manchester.
People just don't understand it because you can't actually physically see there's something wrong.
A lot of my mates, it was quite hard.
International Film Festival. Screen 7, you raised a hand, Mark.
Just to say that Robert's doing his onstage at the Edinburgh International Film Festival tonight, which is Q&A, and it's being hosted by Alan Morrison, who is one of the country's best film journalists, who you've known for a long time anyway.
That will be a fantastic
event and not to be missed.
Thank you.
Now, I'm intrigued by Mr. Golden Rumpelstiltskin. this is Once Upon a Time. Just tell us about this TV series, because I haven't seen it, and I need to see it, and I need to know more.
You must see it, yes. It is, Once Upon a Time is set in two kind of different realities. Basically, every fairy tale character that you've ever read about and known in your childhood, these people were all real. These are real, real people, and they live in fairy tale land. Is a land where they all bump into each other and meet. So Snow White, you know, and Rumpelstiltskin, you know, they know each other.
And you're Rumpelstiltskin.
I'm Rumpelstiltskin, yeah. And what happens in fairy tale land is the evil queen from Snow White, she, through with Rumpelstiltskin's help, puts a curse on the land to kind of destroy everything and everybody, and propels everyone through this kind of portal vortex to this place which becomes known as Storybrooke, and this is now the real world. And so all these people, all these fairy tale characters are then in this town of Storybrooke. They don't know who they are. They don't realise that they were, you know, dopey, grumpy, sneezy, or whatever. And as time goes by, now we're in the third season, they do know by now, but by the end of the first season, I think that's when their memories begin to return. So it's a kind of mad, kind of surreal.
So the other side of Rumpelstiltskin is Mr. Gold.
He's Mr. Gold, who's a kind of antique dealer, pawn shop owner.
So how does Mr. Gold find out that he's Rumpelstiltskin?
Well, you see, he's always known, because Rumpelstiltskin is the one who gave the evil queen the curse in the first place.
And this, so three seasons of this, or three series, as we say in this.
Sorry, we're going to be in North America.
Yeah. So, but this is a huge TV series.
Yeah. It's very. I mean, it's absolutely. You know, the numbers, as they say, are kind of through the roof in America, and even over here, it's shown on Channel 5. Here, and it's got a terrific audience of around about 1 million or something like that for Channel 5. It's a great audience, and it's retained that audience all the way through.
What can you tell us about The Long Midnight of Barney Thompson? Because you've worked with all these great directors in the past, and are you now definitely directing this?
I am definitely about to direct it, yes. I mean, I these things, you don't know, Mark, you know, whether you're going to get the cash, whether it's going to happen or not, but it's...
What's the pitch?
The pitch is you have Barney Thompson, who is a small-time barber in Glasgow, who is beginning to lose his way in the world, beginning to lose his position of power even within the barbershop. And in the barbershop, the position of power is actually the chair that's at the window. And if you move further and further back, you're next thing you're out the door.
Because that's the one that calls the customers in, because they can see the job.
Of course, they can see what's been done. So Barney Thompson is, at this point, he's going back and back and back and back. And through complete and total accident, he kills both of his colleagues. murders both of them. And so then he has to kind of decide, am I going to confess this, or am I going to try and hide the bodies? So of course he tries to hide the bodies.
Of course.
As you would do, yes.
And will you be in it, or are you just directing solely behind the camera?
Madly enough, yes, I'm going to be in it. I am actually going to be Barney Thompson.
Wow.
So I know, stupid.
So we talked about television, and we're talking about movies, which you're running with both at the same time. And there's a very interesting... We've been talking about this a lot recently on the programme, about how a lot of the great creative television is happening in America, and you're doing that, and you're doing great creative work in movies as well. But it wasn't always this way, whereby all this great writing talent went into television. Mm-hmm. And you were in 24, mm-hmm. and I think you've been on record in the past as saying that you think 24 sort of started this new interest for HBO-style TV series over here. Are you very happy flipping from one to the other, and do you think this is going to, essentially, there's going to be, in the future, there's going to be very little difference between the two?
Oh, I think now you can put a cigarette paper between them some of the time, in terms of the production values. Once upon a time, this is astonishing statistic here, that our show is, I think, each individual episode is between $4 and $5 million an episode. So you could make 2 or 3 movies back here for that. So the production values are so high, and all the post-production stuff, all the kind of special effects, etc., etc. It's as big as any movie, it's as good as any movie. Now that, as you say, that was not the case, even, you know, say 15 years ago, you wouldn't have, in particularly American television, you wouldn't have touched it. But now it's got, since I think 24, and, you know, Mr. Gandolfini, rest in peace, just passed away, but Sopranos, you know what I mean, was wonderful as well. And these shows, you know, 10, 12 years ago, suddenly were the beginning of a whole new kind of world of television. And you kind of touched on it there, Simon. I think what was happening is that Hollywood were making less and less films. So the writers, there was less and less work. So they can bled out into TV. And suddenly you've got some fantastic writers now in television. And the quality and the scripts are just wonderful.
But there's also been a complete change in terms of the way the public perceive it. It used to be that if you were a movie star and you went to television, it was seen as kind of stepping down. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's almost like you use movies in order to step up to television. It's become that well respected.
Absolutely. It's interesting for me. I've spent the last few years, in fact, doing quite a bit of study. I just did myself to what we used to call, what was called the golden age of television, which is from about 1955 to 1965 or so, maybe up to 1970 in the States. And if you look at the actors who were performing then in television in America, they were the big stars of the day. They were like Sammy Davis Jr. There was, you know, Dennis Hopper, I remember seeing in some shows. William Shatner was quite a big, big name. You know, he could have went off and done any movie he wanted, but he went off and did Star Trek, obviously, in the end. But you see him cropping up in a lot of these television programs at the time.
Do you find yourself, I wonder if Rumpelstiltskin and that side of the work, is there the fact that you've got a young family, do you kind of take a certain joy in doing stuff that they can watch? Because let's be honest, there's not much of your work then that they're going to be like, hey, come around everybody, Dad's on television.
Scaring yes. Simon Mayer.
Yes, absolutely. Scaring people as usual. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that was exactly why I did it, but it certainly helped. It certainly flavoured it for me that I could actually show my kids what I did, because I think they were beginning to doubt I was an actor at all.
And we've only got about a minute left, but I'm just interested to know, when you're doing scary for kids, is it different to doing scary for grown-ups?
Yeah, you've got to temper it.
I mean, obviously without knives, you know.
Well, Take the knife out of it, yeah. But you've really got to, you've got to temper it. You've got to remember that you've got a young audience. You've got to be aware of that and respect that.
I hadn't realised how much Robert Carlyle scared you, but he's been watching you this whole interview.
He's twitching.
I'm very, very close. I'm going to go home and watch Cracker now, reassured, because Robert's actually a cuddly old bear. That's what Robert Carlyle, thank you very much indeed. We appreciate it. Robert Carlyle,
thank you.
Been on stage tonight at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. Robert, thank you very much indeed. This is 5 Live. Billie Jean King joins us in the next hour.